Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We've got the main event here. We've got the star on the line now. And we're going to be talking to her about her book, Murder by Milkshake. It's an astonishing true story of adultery, arsenic, and a charismatic killer. So we've got Eve Lazarus. Thank you for being here with us today, Eve.
Thank you for having me.
So, Eve, how did you get into writing about true crime?
Oh, true crime actually found me. I started writing about history, like the stories behind old houses and what happened to them and the idea that they kind of had a genealogy or a social history like a person. And when I was doing, this is a book I wrote in 2007 called At Home with History, and when I was looking at these stories, I'd start with the archives and, you know, look at these, or I'd rather I'd start with the houses and I'd look at these gorgeous old houses in Shaughnessy and that had been around and sort of stand outside and skulk around in the hedgerows and wonder what had happened there 100 years ago. And I'd go to the archives and find out not very much, nothing that was particularly exciting anyway. And so I started with a story, and I started looking at areas like the West End and Mount Pleasant and basically working class areas and that had sort of, you know, everyday homes and things like that. And I found these fantastic stories, and I started finding stories about bootleggers and brothels and corrupt cops and murders that had happened in people's kitchens, you know, 50 years ago. And I just really got interested in these stories, and that kind of evolved into a couple of books. It became Sensational Victoria in 2012, and then Sensational Vancouver in 2014, and really looks at these kind of crime history, I guess, of Vancouver. And each book kind of led into another. When I was researching murders in houses for Sensational, I found a couple of cold cases that really bothered me, and I couldn't let go of them, and started researching them, and that kind of morphed into my book Cold Case Vancouver. When I was researching one of those stories, it was a 1944 murder that happened not far from where I live in North Vancouver, and this 24-year-old woman's body was found near the West Vancouver Cemetery. And when I started digging around and looking at that murder, I found that they'd gone to the Vancouver Police Department and to investigate, and they'd brought over this Inspector Vance and to do forensics. And I read that and I thought, wow, we were doing forensics back in the 40s. And when I started, when I went to the police museum and started really digging into it, I found that he was doing it way earlier. And Vancouver was kind of one of the leading cities in forensics in North America. And he was the only scientist connected to a police department at that time. So that became Blood, Sweat and Fear, kind of look into a number of major crimes that he had solved and worked on between 1907 and 1949. But it was still very much in the history of Vancouver, as with Cold Case, very much looking at murders that had happened and how the period of time sort of affected the murder, whether it was the Depression or the World War or corrupt cops or whatever it happened to be.
But I thought Vancouver would be crime-free.
Well, when I first moved to Vancouver in the 80s, I thought, wow, it was such a beautiful, city, but, all the history was kind of these streets named after old white men and forestries and tourism, and it was pretty boring, actually. And then when I started scraping some of the surface here and found some really fascinating crime history of Vancouver, it just made it much more interesting.
I used one of your stories from Cold Case Vancouver, The Babes in the Woods, as reference for one of my episodes on Dark Poutine. Can you talk a bit about that case?
Well, thank you for referencing it. Yeah, that's a fascinating case, and it really goes to Vancouver's icons and Vancouver's dark side. It happened in Stanley Park, that 800,000 tourists visit every year, and it's our kind of leading light. And back in 1953, some park board workers were clearing scrub in this really isolated place near Beaver Lake and Stanley Park, and this guy stepped on a skull, basically. He heard this crunching and looked down, and it was a skull. And he went home and, for some unknown reason, slept on it, and then came back the next day and called police. And police came out to the scene, and they found two children's skeletons, under a woman's coat, and various other things like a lunchbox and a woman's shoe and so forth. And forensics was pretty basic in that year, at least. And they came and they counted the layers of leaves and decided that it had been, the bodies had been there probably 6 years, so 1953 so to 1947. And they, even though sex was really difficult to determine from skeleton remains, they decided that it was a boy and a girl. So they went down this track for 50 years investigating, trying to identify these kids and find out who murdered them. But they were looking for a missing boy and a girl. And when DNA came out in the 90s and they retested the bones, they found that it was actually two brothers. So had they known this, they may have solved it.
Yes, a super fascinating case. And interestingly, somehow Clifford Olson's mother was involved in that case early on, which was always a weird thing to me. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, I think that's in the book. I think she had phoned in a tip from memory.
Yeah,
is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
the children.
And for anybody who doesn't know, Clifford Olson would have been an infant at the time and went on to be one of Canada's most notorious serial killers.
Mm. But, when you're looking at the time period again, and I think that was really important in this case, because they've always thought it was the mother that killed them, and it may well have been. But it was interesting for me to look back. It was just past the war. It was, women had been laid off these, fairly well-paying jobs, in the trades and things, and there was very little safety net for them. Unmarried mothers were just scorned, and there were a number, when I was researching this and looking through the Vancouver Police Department annual reports for that year, there were three other murder-suicides from mothers. One had thrown her children off a bridge and jumped off after them, and two other mothers had just put all their heads in the gas oven and kill themselves that way. They were the only ones mentioned because there was murder involved, but there was no way of determining how many suicides happen as well from women that were so desperate. So it may well have been a woman who was, you know, really desperate and did kill her children. But, you know, they've never been able to identify them.
So now you've written Murder by Milkshake. How did you find that story?
Well, I first heard about it back in the 90s when I was visiting the Vancouver Police Museum. They had a true crime exhibit that featured the Castellani family and the story of the arsenic murder. And I was fascinated by that, and I even included it in my book At Home with History, just filtered through the house where it had happened. And a number of people have written about it, written chapters about it over the years, and it never really occurred to me to write a book about it and until two things happened. And I'd written a blog post. I have a blog called Every Place Has a Story, and I'd just written up a post about it a couple of years after At Home with History had come out, and just talking about the murder. And lucky for me, I made a mistake. I said that Lolly, who was Rini's mistress, had a daughter, and in fact she had a son, and Debbie Wilson wrote to me to correct me and say that was my husband Don, that was her son, and he's been looking for Janine, the Castellani's daughter, for nearly 50 years, you know, and did I know where she was? And I said, oh no, unfortunately I don't know. I'd love to find her too. And then I had my book launch at the Police Museum for Blood, Sweat and Fear in 2017, and Janine came. And she brought her daughter Ashley, and we met up then, and we met up the following week in Cloverdale over coffee, and got together many, many times after that. And it became very important to me to tell the story from Janine's perspective, how the murder affected her, rather than from her father. And do you want me to tell you... just talk a bit about the story of it?
Maybe give us a brief rundown. Us a rundown on it.
Okay, so it was 1965, and Rini Castellani was a minor celebrity with CKNW, a local radio station that's still in Vancouver. And he fell in love with Lolly, the 20-something receptionist, and he decided to murder his wife Esther, his 40-year-old wife Esther, with arsenic-flavoured milkshakes so he could marry Lolly. And he nearly got away with it, and if it wasn't for the rigorous, you know, research and that was done by Esther's doctor after she died, and who had treated her for the 7 weeks that she was in hospital, he really would have got away with it. And Janine, who was 11 at the time that her father murdered her mother, became the collateral damage in all of this. And what all the accounts have failed to do was sort of talk about what happened to her after the murder. Everything seems to have stopped at the murder. And I was very, very interested in kind of that whole 60s period and how the time period affected what was going on and what happened after he went to jail and what happened to Janine. So that's very much a prominent part of the book as well.
With these stories, what is it particularly that'll grab you enough to go write a book? Like, as you hear and go through tons of stories when you're going through different things, what is it about a story that holds you?
Well, in this particular instance, it was Janine. Her story was so compelling. It turned out that after her father went to jail for capital murder, so he was on death row, she was sent to live with his mistress, who was only 26 at the time and had a 5-year-old child herself, and she was financially responsible for Janine. He, even though he was on death row, still had custody of her and wouldn't allow her to see her grandparents, Esther's parents. And so she was completely cut off from all family. She was taken out of the school that she knew, put into another one, and told never to talk about what had happened. And then 5 years went by. She lived with Lolly and Don as a family for 5 years, and then Lolly found a new man. So Janine was sort of taken and dropped like a lost dog off to Rini's sister in North Vancouver. And they were never talked about. Don, having lived you know, together as brother and sister, with Janine having babysat him for 4 or 5 years and becoming really close, they didn't know what had happened to each other. And one of the great things about this book that I'm really proud of is it brought them back together again. So there were a number of really compelling things. The time period, as I mentioned before, was really interesting to me because, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, you fall in love with someone else, why wouldn't you get a divorce? You know, why would you do something as drastic and diabolical? I mean, you know, it was just torturous, you know, death that Esther faced through Arsenic, rather than get a divorce. So that sort of led me to really research divorce laws, and it turns out that it was really, really difficult before 1968 to get a divorce, and it required a lot of public shaming, and they were part of the Catholic Church, so that was another issue. So I guess it became just easier to kill her. And I found that sort of aspect of it really fascinating. And the other aspect I found really interesting too was the time period of this murder, which happened in 1965, just really, really fascinating. And it allowed me to go and research the 60s, which was a period that I've never really looked into. And it was such a time of cataclysmic change in Vancouver. It was, you know, the early 60s, you've still got this emerging beatnik culture, but Vancouver was still very much stuck in the 50s back then. It was a church-going sort of culture. You didn't drink on a Sunday. Women wore frocks. And it just reminds me very much of Leave It to Beaver kind of atmosphere. And so you've got that where really having an affair would have been quite scandalous. But then you've got this change coming that comes in sort of the 1967, 68, and you've got these beings that are coming out from San Francisco, and you've got hippies moving in, and you've got draft dodgers coming in, and Vancouver's just in this massive change.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
There was a lot of change happening in Vancouver at the time. There was Hollywood Sanatorium, for example, over in New West, where the LSD was initially introduced into the culture here, and Acid Al Hubbard was doing his thing with people like Cary Grant were coming to trip on acid and all that kind of stuff. And so all this was happening just a little after after this whole story with Renee. So I believe that society found its freedom, but Esther was kind of a victim of the time.
In a sense, you know, his whole conviction was based on circumstantial evidence, which was also really, really interesting. And when I talked to lawyers and things like that, and saying, well, what would happen today? And it's also a bit of a toss-up whether he'd be convicted now. And the thought was back then that he was convicted more for his infidelity than for the actual murder, which I found really, really fascinating. And, you know, you sort of think, well, why didn't he just get a divorce? And when I started looking into divorce laws from the 60s, it was really, really difficult until about 1968 when the divorce laws changed. Before that, it had to be through adultery. Both parties had to agree, and there was a whole lot of public shaming that went on. So for this sort of arrogant psychopath that Renee was, divorce would have been really publicly shaming for him, and it would have tarnished the image that he was trying to project. And so murder must have seemed like a much easier way for him to get out of it.
Yeah, Renee was in love with his celebrity, being a narcissist the way he was, especially, you know, all the stunts that he would pull. He even talked about, I believe, some sultan was buying Vancouver at one point.
Oh, that was such a great stunt. It was, at CKNW, as all radio stations were back then, they were so hungry for ratings, and they would do anything to boost their ratings and be number one, and CKNW was known as top dog. Their competitor, CKLG, came up with this amazing stunt. There was a TV show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and they brought up the guy that was fronting that and had him just go around and give out cash to people, and it was doing really well, and CKNW were desperate to sort of match this and do better. And they came up with this crazy idea that they would bring in the Maharaja of Alibaba, who was coming to buy BC. And they they hired Renee for the job, and they dressed him up as the Maharaja. They paid for a suite at the Western Bayshore, which was new and swanky back then. They had a couple of women that were on staff. They used to, you know how they do the food demonstrations in supermarkets and stuff like that? Well, they dressed them up as dancing girls, harem girls, and they hired a driver who was this 22-year-old kid that worked in the promotions department and dressed him up as well to drive Renee around. And for 2 weeks they went to football games and they turned up at clubs like the Palomar and the Cave, and he gave out money. And this whole stick was, you know, the Maharaja has come to buy British Columbia. And people were incensed. They really believed this. And they started making signs saying, keep BC British. You know, it was so white back then. Yeah. And it just, this promotion was just this huge success and just incredibly bizarre. And it still dug up some photos from the library that had them from that time and from the newspaper. And I mean, it was incredibly racist. It would never fly now, but it was huge back then.
And these were the kind of things. Yeah, these were the kind of things that he was known for as well.
Well, after he did that, it was so successful that they hired him on full time. And he was mainly in promotions, but he did a lot of the broadcasting as well. And Janine had told me that she and her mum had gone to the Beatles concert in August 1964. And Renee, her dad, had got the tickets, and that he was one of the broadcasters with Jack Cullen, who was quite famous back then in the day. And I thought, oh, really? That's amazing. And then I found this recording, and he was. I mean, it was Jack Wasserman and Jack Webster and Jack Cullen and Renee Castellani doing this iconic concert. And poor Janine, she'd was 11 years old with her mum, and there were 20-odd thousand girls all screaming as pre-teenagers and young teenage girls, and this girl behind her was screaming so much she threw up all over Janine, and Janine and her mum ended up in the bathroom wiping off vomit for the entire, I think, 22-minute concert.
Now, after Renee, or during Renee's court, the court case against Renee, during his trial, wasn't Janine used as leverage by the defense?
Not so much leverage. She was the only defense witness called. So the first trial, he offered no defense, no witnesses, and didn't take the stand.
Right.
And he was charged with capital murder. But it went to appeal, as capital cases would. And on the next trial, he took the stand for 3 hours. And then they put Janine on the stand. And Janine was 13 by now, and she was coached. And I got hold of the testimony, the transcript, from the trial, and I read it back to her when I was doing the book. And I said, was this, you know, read something out, and I'd say, well, was this true? No, that didn't happen. I was told to say that. So she was actually coerced to commit perjury, which was really, really shocking. And something I know that she's still quite bitter about.
Yeah, when I met her, she mentioned that to me, and how you could see the pain in her eyes and in her voice when she speaks about that time and talked about her dad.
Well, I think part of it was, you know, she was 11 years old when her mother died, and she had no one else. You know, he was everything. And she believed him, and she believed he didn't do it right up until she was in her early 20s. And I think, you know, when she discovered that he did, it was horrendous for her, as you can imagine.
And I was going to say, now he poisoned her throughout a period of time. That's not really common for male killers, is it?
Apparently not. Well, at least, you know, in the last century or so. But arsenic was commonly used to off someone you didn't like, or, you know, inconvenient relative or co-worker or something in 1700s and 1800s. And it's really, really a diabolically clever murder weapon. It's when it's given in small doses, you know, it mimics the flu and viruses. And that's what people think it is. So when Esther died, normally, you know, if not for this doctor who couldn't let it go, her death would have gone down as, you know, like a death from a virus or something. So even, you know, when I talked to a toxicologist and said, would this be possible to happen today? He said, oh, yeah, we might miss, you know, 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 20 poisonings because, you know, who would think to suspect arsenic?
Well, I just think that's kind of... So what was the outcome? Like, why did he want her dead?
Wait.
And why...
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, why wouldn't he just divorce her, or why did he choose that way to kill her? It seemed like a really long, drawn-out process.
Well, when I talked to Heather Birch, she's a forensic psychologist, about that, she thought that her impression was that he wasn't trying to kill her initially, that he was just trying to make her a bit sick so he could, you know, she wouldn't nag him and he could spend a lot more time with Lolly. And the other thing you've got to remember was arsenic was really, really easy to get back then. It was in everything, you know, the weed killers and rat poison and all of that sort of stuff. So it wasn't uncommon that you would have, you know, a jar of arsenic, rat poison in your sink, which he did, or weed killer in his case. So what Heather thought, and I tend to agree with her, as she kept getting sicker and sicker, and she went to a doctor and she had all these tests done, and no one could figure out what was going on. When she went to Dr. Moscovich, the internalist, and he put her into hospital, he had four different specialists come and consult on her and put her through 120 different tests, and still no one could figure out what was going on. So I think Rini got really emboldened then. Lolly was probably putting pressure on him to leave his wife, and I'm sure he told her that they were getting a divorce. And it just emboldened him, and I think he probably thought, well, I might as well just do this and get away with it. It's much easier than divorce which comes with all this baggage and public shaming and would tarnish his image, much easier just to kill her.
Well, so what was the response to the public after they discovered he was he'd actually murdered his wife? Did they still like him, or does he have fans?
Well, I talked to a lot of people that knew him when he worked at CKNW in the 60s, people like George Garrett, the reporter, and Norm Groman, who's quite a well-known figure, and they knew him quite well and worked with him. I talked to people, because he got out of jail, he was fully paroled in 10 years and was working in the community even while he was in jail. I talked to people who hired him, people who knew him then, and asked them all what they thought of him, and every one of them really, really liked him. They all said what a great guy he was, how smart he was, how charismatic he was. And I'd say to all of them, do you think he did it? And every one of them said, oh yeah. There was no one that doubted he did it, and they didn't really care, and I just found that really startling.
Wow. So, but we see that going on in other areas in life, in politics too, right? So there must have been something about him that they really, really liked, some charisma.
Yeah, and I guess he did get married again, in fact. But before that, I found his life in jail really, really interesting. I did find someone that had been in jail with him that could sort of talk a bit more about that from the inside. But within a couple of years, he was working for community services in Abbotsford. He was at Maskwee Prison, which was a brand new prison back then, and mainly for drug addicts and drug dealers, and he was one of the few that wasn't part of that. But it was a brand new prison, and he would go and work at community services in Abbotsford during the day and come back to prison at night. And this went on for a couple of years, and the radio station, the guy that was in charge, Bob Singleton, of the station in Abbotsford, and was also on the board of Maskwee, had him come and do promotions for their station, like the Abbotsford Air Show and stuff like that, while he was still in prison, and hired him when he was paroled, just 10 years. Now, this is the guy that got, charged with capital murder twice, escaped the death penalty by 2 weeks when it was commuted, given life imprisonment, and here he is out in the community within a couple of years and fully paroled within 10. Janine remembers, after a couple of years, that he'd get weekend parole and he would bring a new woman around each time. Or he'd say, come and see me in Abbotsford, and he'd be staying with a different woman. Like, it was almost like these women would check him out of jail for the weekend. And, by 10 years when he was paroled, he married again and moved to Nanaimo and started up another radio station with a couple of people. And lived there for a couple of years until he actually died of pancreatic cancer at age 56. Karma.
Yeah.
Wow. What do you want people to get out of your book? Like, when they read this, what do you hope they take away?
I'd like them to see it from a female point of view. I'd like them to see it from Janine's point of view. And I'm hoping that they'll also see it from Esther's point of view. As much as possible, I've tried to give her a voice in all of this, you know, describe what she was like and what she went through and all of that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Huh. Wow. Now, do you have a website or anything that you like to have your fans go to find you? Or?
Yeah, I've got a website. It's evelazarus.com. That's evelazarus.com. I've got a blog there as well, Every Place Has a Story, and a podcast, a true crime podcast that is called Blood, Sweat and Fear, and it was modeled after my book of the same name.
Wow, sounds interesting. Great. Now, we're going to have this book posted on our website as well as your website, and recommend everybody pick this book up. It's a great thrill ride.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Eve Lazarus, and the book is Murder by Milkshake. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Eve. It's been great.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.